Hello, everyone, and welcome to Linux Crazy Podcast. Today, I am pleased to introduce to all of you Chris DeRose. Chris is the owner of DeRose Technologies, an IT solution provider specializing in Linux. I had ran across Chris when I was looking on Craigslist. I like to kind of see what's going on in the world out there as far as what jobs are being offered for people that know Linux, or just see kind of what's going on in the programming world. And I ran across his ad. He was looking for, I believe it was Ruby on Rails programmers. And I was reading it, and I'm no Ruby on Rails programmer, but I was reading it, and I happened to see that it was right here local. I said, whoa, now here's a Linux guy that's right here local. So Chris was nice enough to take me out to lunch. I had a nice cheeseburger off my diet and got to talk, and he's a Linux guy that's using Linux in his business, and I thought it would be interesting to have a podcast with him. So, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, David.
What has your journey been like with Linux, and how did it start?
Well, my journey with computers before I arrived at Linux started with the original Apples, I think the Apple II series. And unfortunately, it took a slight detour with some of the Windows technologies of the 90s. But I think I started to discover Linux towards the mid to late 90s, maybe 97, 98 type years. And I certainly read some press releases in the earlier days of the Internet. And I had worked with some Unix stations prior that I liked very much. But back before Linux was as popular as it was now, it was a very expensive system to work on. System 5 and IRIX was another Unix I had worked with. So I started toying around with Linux, not with the intent of working with it professionally, but with the intent of exploring something new. And I liked what I saw. It was certainly very different then than it is now, and it's amazing when I think of how far it's come. But that's how I got started in this community, which has been a fun community to work with so far.
What motivated you to become involved in programming?
Well, I think I liked computers very much at first, but before the Internet was around, there were very few options other than perhaps games and word processing for someone just to sit in front of a computer and use the computer for the sake of using a computer. So I started to get curious, I think, about how the games worked, and I started to teach myself BASIC originally, and then I think I moved towards C, and since then I've worked with all kinds of languages. But I think it was the curiosity of how such a marvelous device really can function in the way that it does to the end user, and taking it apart and understanding more about how these machines think. That was the big attraction for me.
How did programming for fun turn into a business?
Well, I was approached by a lot of people who knew me as a person who worked with computers to help them with websites predominantly, but other projects as well, databases and business automation type systems. And it was my passion. So when I found people who were looking to pay me to do the work that I enjoyed, I jumped on that. And I guess I did a good job because word of mouth spread, and we incorporated in about 2003 and took on some more employees. And here we are today, still receiving good feedback, at least I think.
What is it about Linux that you would like to see improved?
You know, it's a tough question to answer. I hate to be critical of Linux because I don't contribute nearly enough to the community, so I almost feel ashamed to be criticizing it. But so long as I keep it in a constructive way, I think that the feedback that I would offer to the community, not necessarily to the kernel as well, is that I still think that there are some key applications that are missing in the Linux world, or particularly in the desktop end of the Linux world. I know that amongst my clients, a lot of them are in the building industry, and there's a lot of tools in the building industry that just has no analog in the open source world. I'd probably put AutoCAD is a software towards the top of that list. There's definitely the beginnings of drafting software out there, but I think that there's a real niche in the marketplace for an open source solution that does drafting, perhaps something more like what OpenOffice is to Microsoft Office. I think that there's a real niche there. I think, too, some of the finance applications could use some greater support in the open source world. There's really nothing with quite the same level of user interaction that QuickBooks has. There's some stuff that's pretty good that's more analogous to Quicken. But I don't think that QuickBooks and corporate-oriented accounting packages have a representation in the open source community that they should. And I think there's a need for those two niches and probably a couple other things that I'm not quite thinking of as well.
Yeah, I thought about the same thing as those two main items that you're talking about. And I always wonder why it's never – I guess because people – don't know if they can make any money doing it, spending all that time doing it, or there's just not anybody that's been talented enough that's taken an interest in doing it. I'm not really sure why. Yeah, you hear about the same things over and over again not being available on Linux.
Well, you know, I definitely don't think it's a lack of talent. The most talented programmers I feel in the world right now are working around Linux and Linux related platforms. But I think that as programmers, people want to scratch the itch that they have, which is probably not going to be corporate accounting and probably not going to be drafting. That's the best explanation I can come up with.
What are some of the interesting jobs for your business that you have worked on?
We've done a lot of interesting stuff. I think every year it gets slightly more interesting. This year we've started, we're mostly done with a web-based menu system intended for restaurants, and the deployment would center around a server in a restaurant with a Android-based tablet that would be delivered to the patrons of the restaurant, and there would be a Ruby on Rails-based interface that patrons can use to make their orders, and it's got a nice graphical representation, and there's facilities for calling someone's attention to the table. And then there's some companion presentations in the kitchen and for the hostess as well. So I thought that was a real nice use of Linux and kind of an interesting niche. It should be interesting how the tablets make their way into everyday scenarios, because I think that they're definitely hitting a aggressive price point even now, and that number will go down as the future continues. Conceivably, one can stick them in all kinds of common places that we're not seeing them today. And then, too, it's really great, I think, for Linux users, because Android, though it's a Google platform, it's very Linux-oriented, of course, and it shows how successful the work of the kernel developers and everybody in the community can be applied to this brand-new platform for which nobody even saw the potential 10 years ago or 5 years ago, maybe. And that's one of the more interesting ones. We've done a lot of training, web-based training apps lately, which is an accidental niche we just kind of fell into. So if you can think one part YouTube and one part Stack Exchange and maybe one part testing software, we've done a couple of different solutions like that.
Wow, interesting. I heard about one guy was working on something a little bit similar to that. They were using it to play games in bars where you could play different games at the bar, and then you could order a hamburger or whatever you wanted at the same time and play different patrons at the bar. Something a little bit similar like that you're talking about.
Yeah, and you know what? There actually is, I don't know if this is who you were talking to, if this is what they were working on, but I know that there is a popular platform for playing games at bars, and I've noticed when I've been out and about, if the power went out at the bar or the bartender turned the power off and on, there's that familiar penguin on boot up. And it's a commonplace bar game, and I don't remember the name of it, but it's fairly pervasive. It's funny where you see Linux sometimes. I think it was a Delta flight where they were turning on the personal entertainment systems, and immediately I recognized the Linux boot up. So it's a constant reminder sometimes that even though we may not see Linux on the store shelves here in America with computer sales, in every other niche, I think Linux has just taken off wildly and done very well to the general consumer.
As a programmer, what languages are you using now?
I'm real excited about Ruby and Ruby on Rails. It's become pretty mainstream now. Generally, my history with these things are that I find a language and I use it up to a point at where it ends up becoming mainstream. I would say that probably was the case with, say, PHP. We were a pretty early adopter there. And then as soon as it seems to really hit some critical mass, I often find myself leaving the platform for the next big thing. So far, I've been lucky in choosing the right languages. I think Node.js has a lot of potential, and I'm even thinking about using it in a couple of jobs around here in the future. I'm not sure if I'm going to move all of our new projects over to Node.js. I'm pretty sure we won't, certainly not now, but maybe at some point. But the majority of our work is done in Ruby, and we do some stuff in PHP still, and I think I'm going to incorporate Node occasionally in the next year.
What would be your dream project?
You know, there's a lot of dream projects, but I've been trying to take our company more towards public sector work and both the local and state and federal sectors and doing work for the government. I think what I'd like to see and what I don't see now is a greater adoption of open source by government agencies here in the United States. And I think that when you look internationally, it seems to be more commonplace than when we look here in the States domestically. But it's such a no-brainer to me that you would build your governments off of open-source technologies. You would want to increase transparency. You want to increase peer review and security of solutions. So in my mind, I think that there's probably a couple of dream projects that I could pick, but more so than naming them individually, it's centering around perhaps automating the government functions and government databases around open-source technologies. And I think we'll see that. It may be a matter of time, but that's what I'd like to see us working on more of.
What are some of the other people you're working with?
We work with a number of people for graphics design in the area, and those are some of our partners. There's a Flying Chip Media company here who maybe we'll have lunch with Jeff at some point, who's in town, and that's somebody we work with a lot. We do programming services, and we do more of the technical work. But when it comes to graphics design, we take that out of our office because I think that for the guys here and myself, the skills that make us very good at programming also make us not so good at graphics design. It's kind of funny how that works. But that's one other company that we work with locally. Nationally, we've actually worked with as service providers. We've had some interesting clients. We did a little bit of work with DirecTV. We did some work with a couple other national agencies. We've recently done a good bit of work for a company called Haiti Recovery Group, which is a UN subcontractor. And I'm proud that we actually were able to serve a productive function in Haiti after the earthquake through this partnership. And we even set up a Linux server at one of the UN bases that does routing for the facility. We went in there with some other companies and set up wireless networks in the UN-type compounds and set up some basic internet services for the people that needed help servicing the medical needs and the construction needs of Port-au-Prince.
What do you look for when you're hiring new people?
You know, that's the toughest part of my job, and I was told that when I started my business that it would be, and I think people were absolutely correct. The first and foremost, the most important thing I found when I'm evaluating talent is the passion. Does somebody want to show up and collect a paycheck, or do they care about what they do, and do they want to be rewarded at their desk every day? And certainly I look for the latter. The passion is really important. I care about that more than even experience sometimes. And even education sometimes. And in this business, too, I've gotten very lucky finding people who are good self-teachers, autodidacts, I think is the word for it. There's this phenomenon in computers where people are just able to teach themselves very complicated subjects, it seems, without any formal training. And you wouldn't necessarily want to hire a doctor who's taught himself. But I think that in computers and with programming, there's a lot of great talent out there that doesn't have any formal training or formal credentials. And sometimes I even look for that amongst the candidates. If I see two candidates and they look just about equal, one guy's taught himself and one guy's gone through maybe a college traditional route, I'll usually hire the guy that taught himself because those guys often learn the material better on their own, I've found. So that's what we look for.
Are there any new areas that you would like to get your business involved into?
Well, definitely the government work is their big push. That's not necessarily a new sector for us. We want to take what we're good at and apply it towards the government sector. That's been our big focus lately. And I don't know that there's any other services that we're not already offering that I would tend to offer more of. Perhaps we would get a little bit more into the mobile market. I didn't want to bet the company or bet a good part of the company on iOS because I felt like it was certainly was a closed platform, which I wasn't crazy about. But also, I don't know that that's really going to be the future of the mobile market. I think a lot of the discussion lately has sort of vindicated that suspicion because Android just seems like it has a bigger support with the community. You know, I remember a long time ago when Apple was making their Macintoshes and people liked it very much, but I think Microsoft, one of the reasons that they succeeded in the mid-90s was because they were offering their software for multiple platforms and multiple phones and multiple vendors. And though we don't really think of Microsoft as the kind of company, at least these days, that encourages development outside of the Microsoft sphere, I think that relative to the time, you did see them do that, just that when it came to, yes, selling their own software, but targeting a wide range of hardware. And so I think that history is repeating itself a little bit in the phone market, where here you have Google, who's targeting multiple hardware platforms, and Apple's doing a good job with just its one. And I don't know that it's ultimately going to be successful for Apple this time either.
Describe some of the ways to incorporate Windows and Linux into the business world.
Well, the obvious answer is Samba. We try to steer our clients towards Samba file servers when we can. But even incidental to that, I think that as more and more applications are becoming web-based, the notion of Windows as a value-added component really diminishes. You can use it if you'd like. There's nothing wrong with it. It just costs a little bit of extra money. So I try to plug web-based applications often, and I think that just seems to be the movement, certainly right now. I don't think that anybody isn't advocating that with their products, save for a few holdouts. But using Windows to use web page type applications and web applications off of Linux servers can make sense. It lets people use their existing investment in client infrastructure towards what's inherently a Linux-based solution.
You talked about this a little bit before, but which open source programs would you like to see developed?
Yeah, well, in addition to maybe a QuickBooks and AutoCAD solution, there are quite a few. I think that the virtualization software has helped a lot close some. I would have said years ago maybe the games would have been appropriate, but I think that the virtualization offerings are going to close that gap. And I don't know that that's necessarily an area we need to develop as much in, although it's certainly nice to see when we have Linux native apps that are games that are apps on Linux. I don't know, David. That one I might have to defer because we did kind of cover it.
Yep. What Linux distro are you currently using?
We use predominantly Ubuntu. We also support a lot of Red Hat. We do support some Gentoo. And I know, David, that you are an active member of the Gentoo community, and I like that distribution. I certainly think it's a noble distribution in that it really provides just so many customization and performance-related functionality to different groups of people rather than stuffing everybody into one box. But we often find, I think, that Ubuntu, I think it's easier for a lot of people on the desktop, and I'm not necessarily enthralled with Fedora or Red Hat. I think that the packages that are maintained on Ubuntu are fairly competent. They're not always as new as I would like, but they're generally new enough, and it probably is the easiest for us to maintain. It's the easiest for me to have guys in our office maintain. So we've generally been using it.
I was reading where Ubuntu is going to go with their own desktop. They're going to kind of veer away from. It's going to be GNOME, but it's going to be their own derivative of GNOME, kind of for the desktop on their I guess their next big release. The big thing coming up is GNOME 3, and I guess GNOME 3 is sort of like a you see it on a tablet. Or on your cell phone, kind of where you have your most common apps in one little corner that you could just click on, and what I've seen the screenshots of it. And Ubuntu is going to kind of do their own little thing. That's what I was reading here lately.
I've seen that, and I have mixed feelings about that. I think it's great that for most people that the tools have gotten good enough to where all they need to see is a single icon, and that represents the entirety of what they need to know about the program. I think that's really saying quite a bit for where the user interfaces have gone in recent years. But then and at the same time, I feel like it may not be making the computer science aspects and the programming aspects as obvious to, say, people who are trying to learn the computer. I think it maybe removes a lot of the accessibility of the internals. So I don't know what the right answer is with that. I mean, probably or certainly it's to go with the simplification of the interfaces. But there is a part of me that feels like it's going to come at some sacrifice to people who would otherwise have been inclined to learn more about how their computer works. I know that for myself, I'm sure I'm going to disable anything that removes the file system familiarity that I have from the computer, or that removes the console access. I need those things, and I want to see those things. You don't have to obscure that from my attention. But maybe we're getting old. Maybe the next generation of people in this business will laugh at some of our commonplace idioms that we're used to now. It should be interesting to see.
Yeah, you never know how it's going to play out either. Once it, people might not like it at all, and they'll go, you know, there's no telling where it's going. The nice thing about it is that you don't have to use GNOME in the Linux world. You can, I mean, I'm not a KDE fan, but you can always use Flux. I've used to use Fluxbox all the time and really enjoyed it. I've used XFFE. I've used a bunch of different desktop managers and window environments, and you pretty much have your choice. So if you're used to be a GNOME user and all of a sudden you don't like the way GNOME looks, I'm sure there's something else you'll find that works just fine.
You're absolutely right, and that's another big advantage of the Linux communities, is not only that you have choice, but that because there's choice, there's not necessarily an ingrained mindset, and it forces, I think, different solutions to compete for users, and that competition is probably a good thing for encouraging efficiency and all the things that come with it.
What resources have you found most helpful when troubleshooting Linux?
Well, certainly Google, but also the man pages, and you know, I oftentimes get out a quick S trace and then reference the source code from there even. Sometimes that's easier than going through and scouring over postings on all these expert exchange type sites, or not that there's that many of those in the Linux world, but I think that's pretty standard for all of us. I think for the Gentoo world even more so. Don't underestimate the value of going through code. I can't tell you how many times I've worked on a proprietary platform and you think to yourself, you know, whatever this problem is, it would be so easy if right now I could just look at what was going on, and then you don't get that. But we're in Linux for a couple of reasons, and one of them is the ability to go through source. So I say we should use that ability as often as we can.
What are some Linux programs you find most interesting?
Well, that's a great question. That's a very good question. There's a lot of the graphical programs that I use on a daily basis, Eclipse, Evolution, Firefox. I think that on the command line, I don't know that my answers would be that extraordinary. It's probably the same as everybody listening to the podcast. I'm a Vim user. I get around Vim pretty quickly. Bash as well. I could probably point to more libraries and code snippets that I've discovered recently in the command line, but maybe it's just that I've been doing this for a while, and there's new stuff clearly all the time, but I've fallen into sort of a habit of working with stuff that's been around for more than 5 years now. As a package maintainer, you probably are more aware of the latest and greatest that's been coming out.
Well, I'm kind of like the same thing. You know, it's funny, when I first started using Linux, I've been around computers not that long, since 2000, so... But I first started using Linux, and I wanted to try everything, you know. And now I'm kind of like set in my way. I found what works for me. Now I still, you know, I use OpenOffice some naturally. Now, but I just started using Vim about 3 years ago, and I'm no expert, but I'm still finding new things that I can do with it that really saves me a lot of time. I mean, it's absolutely amazing, all the different tricks and everything that are included, that it's just, as far as me, is just figuring out how to use them all. I mean, so, and a lot of that is just trying to figure out how to do something and researching it and seeing how somebody else is doing it. And you, every once in a while, you'll get a little bitty trick that somebody throws in there, and it's like, whoa. And then you forget about it, but then later on, you start using it a little bit. You remember it again, and I'll start using it. Then after a while, I'll make it like a daily thing, you know, like where every day I'll start using it because it saves me so much time. So I kind of go back to the same thing. Now I use I use Firefox. And I've been using the Google Chromium browser, and I use the OpenOffice. I use GNOME, so I use Gedit sometimes, and Vim, and the GIMP I'll use for doing, you know, simple editing. And that's basically about it. I use pretty much, and I use Audacity for these podcasts. I use Record My Desktop if I want to do a screen capture. But basically, I'll just use the same stuff over and over again.
Yeah, I'm often surprised at how people combine, the whole Unix way of combining tools and little tools that do one job well that can be combined into greater power. I'm often very impressed by some of the very creative solutions that I see, where people take something very simple like Netcat or something like that and turn it into a completely different sort of direction that ends up being useful. That's often more enlightening to me than any specific program that comes out. Although I was actually thinking about it while you were talking, I was looking into Dbus a bit more, and it seems like there's a lot that can be done there. Which that's not a command per se, but as a library for use in your own applications, and there are some command line tools that interact. That's probably something that I'll start using more of. And that, as you may or may not know, is a system for communicating. Events amongst mostly graphical tools, but also system information, so power states and low battery conditions, things like that. There's been a couple of times when I would have liked to have automated some esoteric function, and I didn't really want to get into some specific kernel library to figure out if when my computer is running low on batteries, I want to make sure that my gedit is saved before it goes into shutdown or something like that. And that was something that looked pretty promising to me that I might leverage a little bit more in my own automation.
Yeah, HAL is going out. It's on in Gen 2 world anyhow. It's just about gone. That's the hardware abstraction layer. And UDEV now is going to be there's a library that's going to be directly connected to UDEV that's going to be, you know, talking to the kernel, and the kernel's talking to the hardware. I'm pretty sure that's how it works. But so that's the next big thing, and it's supposed to work a lot smoother than, I guess, you know, there was problems with the hardware abstraction layer communicating, something like that anyhow.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how the goalpost gets moved the more and more you use, or I guess maybe it's just the common human psychology, but the more developers work, the goalpost gets moved. So I often find it interesting. Solutions that I thought were great 4 years ago and I didn't think would get any better, sure enough, somebody invented some way that it was insufficient, and you end up changing a whole bunch of code and libraries over to the newer thing, and then the cycle repeats itself.
Yeah, another program I use a lot that I started using back when I used to use Debian is Midnight Commander. I use it a lot. I use it for my file manager, and I even use it as my FTP client because you learn how to do a little programming. Me, I'm basic simple scripts, but I can make a little script that I can start MC right in FTP and just, you know, and do stuff like that to where I don't have to stop from the terminal and go and open up a FTP client or any of that. I can just do everything just running little scripts that, you know, that I make up myself just to automate things and make things a little bit easier. They're basically pretty simple stuff.
You know, I used to use MC a long time ago. That's been around since the 90s. And I guess I used it before there was FTP support. And I kind of wanted a better console-based FTP client than just the vanilla NC FTP or FTP tool. So I'm going to give that a try next time I'm looking to upload something and I don't feel like starting some GUI tool just to upload a couple files.
What can users do to improve Linux or their favorite distro for that matter?
Oh, well, you should probably know that better than I, but there's so many opportunities. I don't care what your talent is, if it's marketing, if it's graphics design, even if it's politics, there's so much opportunity for advocacy, for design improvements. The obvious help that anyone can give is to learn to program and to program. But even if you don't have any of those skills, bug testing is always greatly appreciated by all developers. There's so many ways that you can help. And I think the community is real good at finding a niche for you. If you raise your hand and volunteer, there's no end of work in sight, not anytime soon.
What are the specs of your current boxes?
I have so many of them. It's tough to say. You know, there's nothing that's actually that impressive, I don't think, on its own. I don't think that the tools that I run require the fastest boxes. And actually, as a developer, I kind of like to work on systems that are a little bit slower than even what's mainstream, because it keeps me more aligned with what the performance is going to be under load. So I don't have anything that spectacular that I can throw out there. We've got predominantly Intel-based, well, all Intel-based CPUs, but predominantly Intel-branded CPUs in our servers. So we usually spec out Xeons on the server side of our equation. And on our desktops, we're really mostly Core 2s, I think. We haven't moved into any of the fancier iStar CPUs yet. I think that we're in an interesting time, though, with computers where it seems like unless you're gaming, the performance matters a lot less than it ever has within reason. And there seems to be more and more of a push towards power savings, which I think is good. Even if you're running a desktop, there's no need in today's world to waste energy if you don't need it. And that's a really neat trend to see. It's quite a departure from the way things have been for so long. But around here, no. We're using pretty vanilla stuff.
I've noticed that it seems like I get more speed if I get a real good and fast hard drive. It can kind of make up for any kind of hardware, you know, that's a little bit slower. These new, now they're coming out. I don't even have any, but I can just imagine what these new solid-state drives would be like using on a computer, even if it has a little bit of slower hardware CPU and stuff.
That's a very good point. In fact, my desktop does have a 10,000 RPM drive RAID array, and
that certainly helps.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, those SSD drives are changing so much too. So many algorithms were written in mind with the constraints of magnetic media, and the SSDs have come, and I guess that's one of those things that every 4 years or so, we thought that all these algorithms were great and they were fast, and then a new piece of technology came out, and now it's no longer sufficient. But particularly in the database world, I think there's a lot of exciting potential, which has been pretty well documented by others, for SSD drives over magnetic drives.
Describe your home and your work network.
Well, I went into my work network a bit. We have the servers which are running Intel, and same with my desk. We use mostly NVIDIA cards around here on our desktops, and then as well as at my home. At my home, I don't have as many computers as I once did. I used to have a lot more televisions in my house, and then I think in a, I don't know, a self-improvement frenzy around New Year's this year, I decided that I was going to start watching less TV and reading more. And so since I pulled out some of the TVs, I only got one TV in my house now. Not that I was very into television, but actually I think it was more that I was into Myth TV at the time than anything else. So I had a number of stations. I think there was a computer to occupant ratio of 4 or 5 to 1 at the time. And now it's down to a more manageable 2 to 1. But my home desktop's about the same as my office desktops. What I really like is these $300 computers that are running the either the Atom processors or I forgot what the AMD version is. And those are great for plugging into your television. They come with HDMI built in, and the Linux support has been phenomenal so far. I don't remember the model I have. I have got a Lenovo Q350, I think it is, at home, and it's very small and portable, and it has great Linux support. And that's another thing, too, that's been really neat to see over the years. It used to be that getting support for drivers on Linux was a problem, and nowadays I almost want to say that there's easier, there's better support for devices in Linux than there is for Windows a lot of times. And or at the very least, with Linux, you don't have to worry about going to some vendor website and making sure you have the right version and all of the nuances that go with it. That might be a testament to how well the packages are being managed these days and than anything else. But that's about what I'm running at home.
The only thing I've noticed that's maybe not support is something that comes out really new, is especially like a real new, like an N wireless device or something, might not be supported right away. But it seems like maybe a year later or so it's supported. I bought one D-Link network USB stick, and I just happened to get version 3 or whatever, and it doesn't happen to be supported right now. That's the only thing I've run across in a long time that's not supported.
Yeah, and you know, that's actually a pet peeve of mine, is these vendors now, they version their products, and a lot of times they don't put the version number on the packaging, and in my mind it's a little bit frustrating. I don't know if I want to use the term ingenuous, cause I don't think they're malicious about it, but you would think it wouldn't be that hard for them just to indicate a number on the outside of the box that you could use to determine if you're going to purchase something. But you know, even in those cases, the situation is better than it was in the past. Certainly with the server products, you'll find that some of the RAID controllers and server-oriented, like some of the higher-end network cards, fiber channel cards, things like that, they'll include drivers for Linux, even if it's not in the kernel. Now, oftentimes, I will say that those drivers are really bad, and they're not open-sourced, and you're probably better off not using the product in some of those cases. But, you know, it's a step in the right direction.
What gives you the most enjoyment within the open source community?
I like the emails, you know. Sometimes there's some rude people out there, but by and large, it's really nice when you open up your email at the end of the day or even first thing in the morning, and there's some guy from Estonia who you've never met before who just sends you a thank you for something you did that helped him out with the website. That always makes me real happy. It feels good. It's nice to know that people care about your work sometimes. And I don't think I need to tell you, David, you seem to work real hard over there with what you're doing. Sometimes you spend a lot of time on something that you don't know if you're the only person in the world who cares about some nuance that you found in the way your program works, and there's a bug, and maybe it only happens under very rare circumstances, but then you get that email from somebody, and you know, this almost goes back to what we touched on earlier about how can you help in the open source community. I think that even if you had only 5 seconds in your day, and you wanted to just maybe help somebody in the open source community, write them a thank you email. That doesn't take much time, and that gives a motivation to them to continue what they're doing. And I think that's one of the really cool things about the community when I get those emails.
For someone wanting to be employed with an open source friendly company, what skills should they be working on?
You know, it's really hard for me to find talent, and I feel like it's the easiest thing in the world if anybody wants to break into. So I'm glad you asked me that question, actually, because I've thought about that a lot. I think that for anybody who wants to get into the business, they should definitely treat it like it was a career, and they should put time into it every day. But stay up to date, keep a blog, contribute to open source projects, and read as much as you can. And as long as you document your work in some public capacity, I think that it would take some time, but it may not be more than even a couple of years of time. And you can position yourself prominently in the community in such a way that you'll get hired pretty quick, even by some companies. You know, I noticed actually, and this was kind of neat. This actually was part of how we did some recruiting ourselves. I got this idea from somewhere else. I was doing a search for something, and it was related to Node.js. And one of the, is it Meebo? One of the social media companies was advertising in the Google search results that they were looking to hire people, and it was neat to see, because I guess only certain people would be searching for what, I don't even remember what it was. There's something definitely related to Node.js, but only certain people would be searching for that. I guess their thought was that if you're searching for this very esoteric thing, then you must know enough about Node.js to be useful to our company. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's probably a lot of little niches out there like that, and I don't want to disclose all my secrets, but I can testify that we did something very similar for our last hiring round, and that ended up working well for us. So I think if you try hard, you keep up to date, and those things should be easy if you're passionate about what you do. I think that the opportunities will come to you before you know it.
Chris, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, David. I think that we covered all the big stuff. It's been a pleasure getting to know you lately, and certainly I think it's wonderful what people such as yourself do for the community. Sometimes it almost makes me feel bad that I'm making money doing what I do, and maybe I shouldn't be. I don't know. But maybe that's a goofy thing to say. But there's a lot of really great people out there in the Linux community, and it's nice to be a part of that, and even in a small capacity. And I guess I'd like to thank anybody over there at Gentoo and at Ubuntu and at all the other distributions who are package maintainers and all the developers and all that really make it possible for us to do what we do and what I do every day.
Well, I think most people would, this is just my opinion, but I get awful excited when I see somebody that's using Linux and they're able to make money doing it. I mean, that's the dream job right there. I mean, I don't care who you are, no matter what you're doing, if you can, whatever you're doing is in your job, that you're able to make money doing it and you love doing it. And you're also, in your own way, you're helping out a lot of other Linux users without you even realizing it, because it just gives a good name to Linux all the way around. When a company like yours is able to use Linux and sell Linux, it's good for everybody. It's a win-win situation.
Thank you, David. You know, one other thing I think I'd like to add, too, is I think, and this kind of ties into what you asked me earlier, about what motivated me and how do I get into Linux. I think I was a little lucky that I kind of came around at a time when the computers were still complicated enough to where they weren't immediately obvious and you had to dig around a little bit, but accessible enough to where you could get on the internet and learn more. And you know, we talked about how maybe the future of some of the Ubuntu interfaces and such are going to obscure a lot of the technical details. I think it's important that as a community, you know, we keep on reaching out to people like this and how you're doing, because a lot of them are going to be young people, and the young people are real important to keep motivated, and they're good for the economy, they're good for society, all the STEM education type efforts that are done by the government that are good, noble efforts can be done by people in the Linux community and are done by people in the Linux community, and I think it's nice when you have podcasts and information archives and all of that to reach out towards young people particularly.
All right. Fantastic. Thanks a lot for the interview, Chris.
Thank you, David. I appreciated being a guest. And maybe I'll come back on another time if you invite me, and I can report some exciting things, hopefully, that I've done for the government even.
Oh, that'd be cool. All right. Thanks again.
Thank you, David.
Okay. Talk later.